Okay, where are we in this course? Before I begin, does anyone have any questions they want to raise or things they want to ask you about? No? We're interested in the changing structure of international politics and what the political consequences of that changing structure are. And one of our basic strategies for getting at that issue was to look at the problem through Bismarck's eyes. Bismarck made a basic political choice in 1879 when he agreed to the alliance with Austria. Alliances are important because they symbolize basic political choices. They're not important so much for legal reasons. I'm going to come back to this point later in the lecture. The basic political choice that Germany made was that Russian expansion in Europe had to be contained. Right? You could see that in the Romanian Treaty. Romania would be an iron barrier across Russia's path of expansion. This contradicted what Bismarck often said, which was that the ideal solution for the Balkans was to divide it, to partition it, into two spheres of influence, a Russian sphere in the east, include Bulgaria and go down to the Turkey Straits, and an Austrian sphere in the west. Right? But his policy was really based on the premise that that kind of solution, a partition of the Balkans, would not be politically viable. Because once Russia dominated the Eastern Balkans, there would be nothing to prevent her, really, from spreading her control over the Western Balkans as well, from outflanking Austria-Hungary, from being the champion of the Slavs, who wanted not only to liberate themselves from the Ottoman Empire, but to basically destroy the Habsburg monarchy as well, to create Slav states throughout Eastern and Southeastern Europe, right? Which would mean the end of Austria-Hungary, which would mean the weakening of Germany's political position in Europe, because Austria, although she was the weakest of the five great powers in Europe, was a significant power and played a certain role in the European equilibrium and in balancing Russia. If Austria disappeared, then Germany would really be crushed between France in the West and Russia in the East. Right? Wanted to avoid this. And a lot of Bismarck's policy in the subsequent period can be understood in his attempt to kind of struggle against the possible negative consequences of its fundamental political choice. Right? You're opting for Austria, that means ultimately you're opting against Russia. Opting for a policy of containing Russia. Why should the Russians put up with that? Why should the Russians continue to prefer you to France? Wouldn't it make more sense in such circumstances for Russia to join forces with France so that the two of those powers could together more effectively pursue a revisionist policy in Europe? That's the great nightmare. You want to do what you can to prevent that situation from coming into being. And that's the key to understanding Bismarck's policy in the 1880s. Right? You want to maintain a certain decent relationship with Russia. Why? Because you want to give the Russians something to lose if they cut their tie with you and they go over to the side of France. This is a way of kind of holding them. Plus, It limits your own dependence on your remaining ally, on Austria. You want decent relations with Russia so that you could maintain something of a free hand and thus of a dominant position on continental politics, or central position, to kind of more accurate about. All right? And so how can you do that? How can you maintain a certain relationship with Russia without abandoning Austria, without disinteresting yourself from the course of political developments of Southeastern Europe? If German power is not thrown into balance, Russia's a stronger country than Austria, so Russia could move ahead. Well, you needed to do something else. You needed to bring in England as a counterweight. The more England sided with Austria against Russia, the more British power was thrown into the balance on behalf of a policy of containment, the less Germany would have to show her hand, the more easier it would be for Germany to play this kind of game, right? And so that's so Bismarck wants to maintain also a certain decent relationship with the British. It's the meaning of the Mediterranean agreements. Decent relationship with Russia. Meaning of the reinsurance treaty, the 1887 system. Both sets of agreements are from 1887, right? This is the best you can do. It's not perfect, but it's the best you can do. And it's quite striking that the system fell apart, not because it was inherently unworkable, not because the Russians saw through what Bismarck was doing and decided not to go along with it. It fell through because of a decision the German government itself made after the fall of Bismarck. To abandon this decision, to abandon that policy, in favor of a clearer policy, more, you know, less ambiguous, less hypocritical or duplicitous policy, to opt for a clear policy of alignment with Britain and abandoning the special relationship with St. Petersburg. It's the Germans that pushed away the Russians. Right? And yet, when the British, at the time of the Rosebery War in 1894, make it clear that they're willing to continue with the Salisbury policy, policy of the Mediterranean agreements, the policy of siding with Austria in a block directed at the containment of Russian expansion, the Germans refused to go along with it. They had placed all their bets on their ability to develop a close relationship with Britain, and then when the British basically are forthcoming, the Germans don't want to have anything to do with it. Right? It's not a rational policy. This is our central theme in the course. A lot of people think that to understand war, war is built into the very structure of a system based on power. The Waltz argument, the argument that was laid out in that article you read, in the first week of this quarter, right? The notion is that countries that pursue policies that are rational in power political terms, that correspond to the basic imperatives that are generated by this kind of system, well, those policies will just take the world into war, right? You don't need any element of irrationality. You know, it's the system itself that's responsible. It's the system itself that pushes states into a collision course with each other. And yet over and over again, you look at what's going on. You see, this doesn't make sense in power political terms. These are not rational policies that are basically brought into being by the fundamental structure of the system, by these structural imperatives. But still, by the early 1890s, you have a certain structure in international politics in Europe. You have these two great continental blocks of approximately equal power. Germany and Austria on the one hand, and Russia and France on the other hand. So the Franco-Russian alliance comes into being. And so the basic structural question, the question of what sort of form European politics is going to have, is going to be determined by the choice that Britain makes. Which way Britain? That's the dominant question of the 1890s. Which way will Britain go? Will Britain side with one or the other of the two continental blocks, or will Britain remain aloof? Right? Whichever choice Britain makes, well, that's going to have a huge bearing on the kind of structure that European politics is going to have. Right? That's the central issue of the 1890s. And we saw this great debate that took place in Britain at the time. Right? On the one hand, there's all this pressure to end British isolation, you know, rooted in this fundamental structural factor that Britain's relative power is in decline. That Britain's position in the world, which she had acquired early on because of her lead industrialization, this no longer corresponded to the distribution in the basic economic power and thus ultimately of military power. Britain's resources are now overextended. On the other hand, German power is on the rise. Germany has this goal of shifting her position in the world in a way that would correspond to her basic power. Right? That's a fundamental structural problem. Yeah. And it's highlighted at the time by certain political developments. Britain's increasing vulnerability to other powers. Not in Europe, but in the overseas world. Right? Britain is the one that feels the brunt of France and Russia coming together in 1890. Britain is concerned about, are her resources overextended, especially in the period of the Boer War at the turn of the century, when it seemed, judging from the press, that there was a certain chance of all the continental countries ganging up against Britain. Right? And that sense of Britain has overextended. Britain can no longer afford to hold herself aloof from the continent to the extent that she had. Right? Again, never isolated in the sense that the United States was isolated. Britain was always interested in these European affairs. When people talk about isolation, British isolation, what they mean is the policy of the free hand, the policy of not committing yourself to one or the other of the continental powers. Okay? No alliances. Increasingly, the notion was that Britain couldn't afford that luxury anymore. Britain had to side with one or the other of the continental blocs. Right? Britain had to try to reduce all these pressures on her position because she was so overextended. So she tried, you know, she tried to reach an accommodation with Russia, for example. But the Russians, sensing British weakness and British vulnerability, weren't willing to do it. And the British also looked to Germany, these Anglo-German alliance overtures, again, at the turn of the century. You know? And it's the 1898 to 1901. And again, it's the Germans who are uninterested in this. Who needs whom? The Germans said, well, the British are the ones who are under pressure. They need us more than we need them. We can strike a hard bargain with these people. Okay. And in the end, the British abandon isolation. Salisbury's views are defeated. Salisbury has to give up the foreign ministry in the year 1900, and is replaced by Lansdowne, and the British first make this alliance with Japan, kind of limited liability, right? They are not going to go to war on Japan's side in the event that that Japan and Russia find themselves at war, only if another country comes in, and this alliance is limited to the Far East then, right? But it's an important beginning. And then in 1904, you find the British making their entente with France, right? Entente with France, 1904. You know, in the midst of the Russo-Japanese War, a war that pitted Britain's ally Japan against France's ally Russia. Right? Those two countries, France and Britain, come together. You know, you always pay a price when you enter into a relationship with the price is you're limiting your own freedom of action. You're allowing the gap between yourself and third countries, in this case Germany, to deepen. And that's going to have important political consequences. Britain makes this entente with France. Does this mean that it's explicitly directed against Germany? They're doing this because they sense the rising German threat and are moving to construct an anti-German coalition that could balance Germany's aspirations for hegemony? Well, yes and no during this period. Well, a lot of this stuff is implicit in the policy that the British pursued. You know. 1904 and 1905. It has certain anti-German overtones, but they're implicit, right? It's like, for example, the British feel that everyone else, all the other countries, even minor countries like Italy and Spain, should be accommodated, should be brought on board. You should make concessions to them to kind of support what the French want to do in Morocco, namely take over that country, or what the British want to do in Egypt, which is also tighten their control on Egypt, but not Germany. When Germany makes these same demands, Germany is a blackmailer. When France or Russia or some other country make demands, well, that's normal. That's the way international politics works. You play that game. In other words, there's something non-rational that comes into play here. This is not simply the rational workings of power politics. Salisbury and you know his collaborators like Lord Sanderson, his permanent undersecretary in the British Foreign Office under Salisbury, you know, they felt like Germany didn't have to be alienated to that extent. You didn't have to side with one or the other blocks. There were, you know, they were not going to gang up against you because they needed you against each other. They didn't want to push you onto their rival side. You wanted to give them something to lose. You wanted to make sure that they had something to hope for. You didn't want to side too clearly with one block or another. You wanted to maintain a certain relationship with both sides. Well, that's rational power political thinking, right? It's never in your interest in power political terms to alienate another country, right? Because the more you alienate another country, not only do you pay the direct price of problems with that country, but you also pay a big indirect price in terms of increased dependence on your own allies or your own entente partners. And when the more dependent you are on them, the more you're pretty much forced to pursue policies that might run against your better judgment. Yeah. The big German decision to start a major to build a major navy was made in 1897. Okay. The British are still trying for an alliance with Germany as late as 1901. If you have good relations with another country, you want that country to be as strong as possible. From the standpoint of these more balance of power oriented types, people like Salisbury, it's, you know, for Germany to acquire colonies is not a bad thing. You get two benefits. First, those German colonies become hostage to your navy, to your naval power, right? If they get involved in a war with you, you can take those colonies away from them. They want to avoid that, so they're going to be nicer to you. So there's that argument. And people make these kind of arguments. Plus, if you're seen by the Germans as sympathetic with their national aspirations, they're not going to go over to the side of your adversaries. They're going to be much more inclined to give you political support. I don't mean to imply that there's nothing to that. Because the Germans are building a navy against whom? Well, they tried to cover it up, but they weren't totally successful. It was against the British. The Germans wanted to displace Britain as the world's premier imperial power. That meant that the Germans were going to have to build a strong navy. Again, and this is in keeping with our central theme here, is that rational? Well, if Germany was on good terms with all the other powers in Europe, didn't have to worry about pouring its resources into a strong land army, well, then you can say, it might have been rational for the Germans to want to do that, given their basic assumptions. The problem is, Germany already has these big problems with France because of Alsace-Lorraine, and with Russia because of Germany's opting for the policy of containing Russia, symbolized by the alliance with Austria. If you have those two quarrels going on already, can you really, sustain a third quarrel? If your concern is security, and this is what theorists like Waltz and Mearsheimer assume, the country's main concern is with their security, well, then you don't want to quarrel with England. You don't want to have to divert your resources into the construction of a big navy. You know, you want to concentrate on having a powerful land army. Germans don't go that route. You know, it makes you wonder, is this rational statecraft? Are the problems that develop to be understood as a normal accommodation to these central imperatives created by the fundamental structure of the system based on power and so on? You gotta wonder, right? So you have Britain increasingly pursuing a policy that has anti-German overtones, associated to a certain extent with the sense that Germany is their principal adversary, that Germany has this great dream of knocking the British off their pedestal and displacing Britain as the world's chief imperial power. Okay? And this British policy, implicit, already under Lansdowne, becomes explicit in the succeeding government, liberal government. The foreign secretary here, the key maker of British foreign policy during this period from the end of 1905 on, was Sir Edward Grey. Okay. Germany is now the central threat. Partly this is for structural reasons. It's because Russia's defeat at the hands of Japan had basically solved the Russian problem. Right? Now Russia realizes that she needs to reach an accommodation. Take British power into account, because Britain and Japan are close. They renegotiate their alliance after Russia's defeat. They extend it to India, for example. Russian fleet is no longer a problem. It's been sunk by the Japanese. Russia's no position to pursue a revisionist policy because of these military defeats, plus the domestic political turmoil, the 1905 revolution in Russia, that they were linked to. So as Russian power is no longer the problem, German power kind of emerges as much more important. And you see British policy during the first Moroccan crisis having an increasingly anti-German tinge to it. Not just supporting the French, living up to their commitments to support the French diplomatically on Morocco, but being upset by the fact that the French have any interest in reaching an accommodation with Germany. Right? The foreign minister who was responsible for the French forward policy in Morocco, Delcassé, when the Germans made it clear after the Kaiser's speech in Tangier in early 1905 that they weren't going to simply accept the French gobbling up this colony there. Delcassé was forced to resign. British are very upset. British are very upset when the Prime Minister, Rouvier, tries to strike a deal in private negotiations with the Germans. The British try and push the French to taking a tougher line. French resent this. Who's going to have to fight this war? French are not in a good position to fight a war, to seek a military showdown with Germany, precisely because their main ally in Europe, Russia, is so weak, in no condition to go to war, you know, above all on behalf of what would amount to an aggressive French policy. Right. And then you look at the aftermath of the crisis. You know, you're an impartial observer. You look at the Moroccan crisis. Here's Germany in a very strong position. Strong position legally, because the independence of Morocco had been guaranteed by the powers, the Act of Madrid of 1880, and above all, in a very strong position militarily. Russia's weak, the French army is in, you know, not such great shape because of the repercussions of the Dreyfus Affair in France. Britain is in no position to send a large land army to Europe in any case. And yet, the Germans prefer a huge diplomatic defeat to a war, even a war that they would have no trouble winning, right? Well, that should show you that the Germans are, this is not to be understood as an act of aggression, pure and simple. The German decision to kind of provoke them the Moroccan crisis. What the Germans had been trying to do is, you know, engage in this diplomatic maneuver. You know, show the French, demonstrate to the French just how much they needed friendship with Germany. So the confrontation with France would be the prelude to a continental bloc against Britain. And they noted the fact that the British had used the same tactic with the French, right? The confrontation with France at Fashoda in 1898, you know, under Delcassé. Delcassé was the French foreign minister at that time as well. The confrontation at Fashoda had led directly to the Anglo-French Entente 6 years later, under that same Delcassé, right? Yeah, you know, there's a certain logic here. The Germans could do the same sort of thing. But this kind of fear of losing France, you know, led the British to think that they would have to outbid the Germans for the loyalty of the other continental powers. Not just France, but Russia as well. Because you have the Moroccan crisis being resolved in 1906 with this German humiliation, in spite of military strength and everything. Moroccan crisis resolved in 1906, and it's followed in 1907 by the conclusion of a very important agreement between Britain and Russia, leading also to the formation of an entente between those two countries, political accommodation, Anglo-Russian Entente of 1907, and that together with the Franco-Russian Alliance and the Anglo-French Entente means that you now have, 1907, a third, a group of three powers coming into being. The Triple Entente, Britain, France, and Russia. Triple Entente. Why did the British want this? Notion was, I mean, they had been trying for good relations with Russia for a long time. Finally, the Russians realized that they needed a decent relation with the British as well. Increasingly also as kind of a counterweight to Germany, because Germany had ambitions in the Ottoman Empire. The Berlin to Baghdad Railroad project, very famous project, is the symbol of Germany's ambitions to kind of extend her influence into that area, which is an area of vital strategic importance for Russia. So an alignment with Britain makes sense, Russia's point of view. Russia can't expand anymore in East Asia or in the or even in Central Asia because of this new widened Anglo-Japanese alliance. The Russians look now increasingly toward their south, toward the Turkish Straits, toward the Balkans. So the 1890s, those continental issues relating to the Balkans, had been in the background. Imperial issues had been in the foreground. Now it's changed. Russians have an interest in it. The British have an interest in it. And again, increasingly, a lot of this stuff has an anti-German coloration, you know, coming together against Germany. You always pay a price. Again, I've said this a number of times. You know, countries make alliances. They choose which countries are going to be their friends. It's also choosing which countries are going to be their enemies. There's a price you pay. In this case, the more strongly you side with France and Russia, if you're British, then the weaker your ties with Germany become. The Germans feel like they have nothing to gain from you. So the opposite of the whole Bismarck strategy. And you become the slave of your own allies. Anglo-Russian Entente, 1907, like the Anglo-French Entente, was not simply a general political agreement. It also provided for the resolution of a number of important political disputes. most notably the dispute over what was then Persia, contemporary Iran is then called Persia. And Persia was carved up into spheres of influence. You know, the whole north of Persia, including the capital city of Tehran, and the number two city, Isfahan, were in the Russian sphere of influence. The British recognized that. A secret part of the influence. And the British sphere was in the south. Just a very small area of certain strategic importance at the top of the Persian Gulf. You notice that the British are violating their liberal principles. You recall how Crow in the Crow Memorandum has this whole argument about how Britain is the defender of small countries, the defender of liberty, and all that kind of thing. Obviously hypocritical if you look at what the British Empire was, but in this particular case, they're basically sacrificing the independence of Persia. No longer Persia is a buffer state. You're going to allow the Russians a free hand in the most important part of that country. You're paying a big price there. Because you want Russia on your side. And you can't simply assume that Russia, threatened by Germany, has a strategic interest in aligning herself with you, and therefore you don't have to pay any additional price. You have to pay a certain price. So you have this Anglo-Russian on top. I want to make an important point about this new structure that came into being in 1907. Triple Entente versus Triple Alliance. A lot of people think that this was a cause of the First World War. A lot of people think that you want to understand the First World War? Not hard to understand. It's the alliance system. It's the arms race. It's the old diplomacy. These ideas played a very important role in the whole Woodrow Wilson phenomenon at the end of the war and of great power politics in the interwar period. A lot of people still believe this sort of thing. These great meta-historical forces, the arms race, the alliance system, the old diplomacy that didn't take into account moral principles. This was the heart of the problem. And this notion was that these two blocks were these kind of rigid blocks, rigid alliances. What are the consequences of rigid alliances? Well, you see, Waltz made this argument in that article. It meant that anyone could draw in their allies. A weak ally could basically force a stronger ally into a war, even though the stronger ally didn't want to do it. It was committed. Its alliances were rigid. Didn't have any choice. Okay. The more intelligent, more sensitive international relations theorists, people like Robert Jervis, they understood that, no, that was not the right way of looking at these things. The problem was not the rigidity of these alliances. The problem was that they weren't quite rigid enough. That they were loose, that they were soft. In particular, Russia's alignment with the two Western powers. Right? Russia didn't have to commit herself to them. Russia retain a certain degree of freedom of action. Russia could conceivably, you know, weaken her alignment with the West and reach some sort of understanding with the Germans, because the Germans felt that the development of a certain relationship with Russia was the way to go. They could conceivably do this. In the middle of the Russo-Japanese War, I think I mentioned this. The Kaiser and the Tsar had this rendezvous with Bjorko off the coast of Finland. They signed a treaty of alliance. The whole idea was, you could work out some sort of deal between Germany and Russia. The Russians were happy to make sure that the Germans, you know, kept this in their minds as a real possibility. Because as long as a decent relationship with Russia, between Russia and Germany was in the cards, that would lead Germany to accommodate Russia more than she otherwise might, to kind of distance herself from Austria more than she otherwise might. It would be in Russia's interest to do so, right? But the mere fact that Russia could conceivably defect from the side of France and Britain and move over toward a warmer relationship with Germany meant that Russia was in the driver's seat. See, this is the most important structural consideration here. There's bound to be a competition for Russian favor. The more Germany is going to court Russia, because Russia made it clear she's keeping the door open to Germany, the more Britain and France are going to have to up the ante in terms of the price that they're going to have to pay for the continuation of their relationship with Russia. So you have a bidding war, a competition for Russian favor. You have to, you know, keep upping the ante. You have to keep paying the price. Right? And this is a source of empowerment for Russia. One of the most striking things about this decade before the First World War is here's Russia, very weak. Weak internally. The most backward of the great powers in terms of economic development, militarily weak because of the consequences of the Russo-Japanese War, and yet Russia is in the strongest position of any of these European powers. Why? Because her diplomacy was able to keep the lines open to both Germany on the one hand and Britain and France on the other hand, so that each of those countries would seek Russian favor. They wouldn't give up on Russia. They would have a sense that they had something to lose from Russia, that Russia might defect to the other side. It's the softness of the Entente relationship that made this possible, not its rigidity. Right? And the main political effect of this was to create in Russia the sense that she now had enough power in the system, for political reasons, not military reasons, enough power in the system to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans. Russia, again, it's so easy to say, oh, well, look at Germany. The Kaiser is a little off his rocker. Germany is this aggressive country. You want to understand the First World War, very simple explanation. It's a war of German aggression. Not true, right? Not, or we'll put it this way, not that simple. Because who were the revisionist powers during this period? Not just Germany. France overseas, and in Europe, Southeastern Europe, Russia as well. And you pursue a forward policy in the Balkans, especially on a base of military weakness, you're playing with fire. But Russia was able to do this because the gap between Germany and the Western powers had opened up so wide that each of them had an incentive to bid for Russian favor. Right? Very similar, by the way, to the situation that existed before the Second World War. Again, a competition for Russian favor in the summer of 1939. Okay. That's the backdrop to the events of 1908-1909. You have this Triple Entente coming into being, not rock solid. The British have to give the Russians more and more. You could see it in terms of the kind of concessions the British are making in Persia. And the Russians also feel like they're in a position to pursue a much more active policy, not in the Far East anymore, but in Southeastern Europe. And this is possible because also Austrian policy has shifted. There had been a certain tradition in terms of the management of Southeastern Europe that both Austria and Russia would have a say in what went on. And I put on the blackboard some of these names. The Reichstag agreement prior to the Russo-Turkish War in 1877, which basically said regulated the outcome of that war. You know, Russia would get Bessarabia, Austria would be allowed to annex Bosnia in the Western Balkans. There was this kind of tradition there was this principle of dual control, the Nürnberg Agreement. I think that was 1903, but this principle of dual control between Austria and Russia governing the Balkans went back to like 1897. You know, each of them had vital interests there. They recognized each other's vital interests. They would work together. And you can understand why both Russia and Austria had an interest in this sort of thing. Austria, for her part, didn't want to be so dependent on Germany. It was not, you know, terribly confident that in the moment of truth, Germany would side with her. And so under the Austrian foreign minister, his name is Golchowski, late 1890s or early 20th century, there was this whole sense of let's work together with Russia, but let's not push these issues, let sleeping dogs lie. But that changed when he was replaced as Austrian foreign minister by Baron Ehrenthal, who wanted to pursue a much more active policy, a policy built, and see, this is the big irony of this whole thing, built on the idea that Austria's position had to be strengthened by strengthening of the Austro-Russian relationship, by developing this understanding with Russia so that Austria would become a more independent country and not simply a satellite of Germany. Right? And the Russians, for their part, felt like if they wanted to move ahead in the Balkans, it made sense to do it in cooperation with Austria. And they did want to move ahead. The new Russian foreign minister, Zvalsky, he wanted to develop Russian policy in the direction of the Turkish Straits, Constantinople. You know, basically dominate the Turkish Straits, the keys to our house, the Tsar had called them. Make sure that no foreign warship could enter the Black Sea through the Turkish Straits, but that Russian warships would have access to the Mediterranean through the Turkish Straits. Change the rule of the Straits, obviously penetrating Russian power into that area, a goal that's partly aggressive and partly defensive, because they're all, you know, the Russians are also worried about German ambitions in this area. They have to move forward in order to kind of neutralize the German aspiration of bringing the whole Ottoman Empire under German influence. Okay, so Ehrenthal and Zvalsky have a common interest in working together, and they strike this deal at this castle of Buchlau. I think it was in 1908, and the idea was, each of them would support each other's aspirations in this area. Austria would support Russia's desire for a change in the rule of the Straits, and Russia, for her part, would support Austria's interest in consolidating her position in Bosnia. Now, even though the Russians had agreed prior to 1877 that the Austrians could annex Bosnia if they wanted, the Austrians chose not to annex Bosnia, but simply to occupy it and to administer it, right? Because they didn't want more Slavs within the Austrian Empire. They were concerned very much about the balance between the different national groups within the Austrian Empire. But their attitude had changed in large part because Turkish policy had changed. There had been a revolution in Turkey, a liberal revolution. Third world nationalist movements before World War I tended to be liberal, just as in the interwar period they often had a fascist tinge, and in the post-World War II period a kind of socialist tinge. This new Turkish government called the Young Turks had come into being, and they wanted to strengthen the Ottoman Empire, and the whole situation in Bosnia was anomalous, and they found it hard to tolerate. And then there was also the whole problem of the change in Serbian policy, which is now kind of more aggressively anti-Austrian than it had ever been. And it seemed like the Serbs were getting at least moral support and to a certain degree political support as well from Russia. Right? So you wanted to kind of move ahead in Bosnia to kind of make it clear to the Serbs that they couldn't hope to get any more territory your expense. That their whole dream of becoming the nucleus of a new Yugoslav state, carved not just out of Turkish territory, but out of Austrian territory as well, you were going to have to show them there was no chance of that. All right? So the deal was that the Russians would also, in exchange for Austrian support for their aspirations toward the Turkish straits, they would be able to, the Russians would also support the Austrians in transforming the regime in Bosnia from mere occupation to a full part of the Austrian Empire, to accepting the annexation of Bosnia. But no big deal. And as for the other powers, France would go along with the French care. Germany is interested in good relations with Russia. Germany would go along probably. And the British were traditionally Russia's greatest adversary there with regard to the Turkish Straits. But British policy was increasingly accommodating toward Russia. The British had a real interest in good relations with Russia. Plus, there was an indigenous factor on the British side, namely British strategic thinking had changed dramatically, in large part as a result of the British occupation of Egypt and its consequences. Because the whole focus now of British strategic thinking in the East Mediterranean was on consolidating their position right by the Suez Canal, the whole Cairo-Suez area, big British base over there. And that meant that they didn't need to worry so much about Russian penetration of Constantinople anymore. As long as they were entrenched in Egypt, their lifeline to India would be secure. Right? So the notion was the British would also go along with this stuff. The ironic thing is that this is an attempt at collaboration between these two powers, Austria and Russia. And it leads, and this attempt at collaboration, because of technical factors, an utterly incompetent diplomacy, mostly on the Russian side, but also to a certain extent on the Austrian side, leads to a showdown, a crisis, a very serious situation. Because Aerenthal moves ahead in terms of his side of the bargain, namely the occupation of Austria, of Bosnia, without consulting the Russians, and before Izvolsky had gotten the consent of the other powers in Europe to supporting him and cashing in on his side of the bargain about the Turkish Straits. And there's this huge uproar in Russia, and a huge uproar in Serbia. And the Russians basically renege on their promises to Izvolsky, and it seems like there can be real trouble because the Serbians are saying that they refuse to accept this, and the Austrians have to maintain all these troops under arms. And so by the spring of 1909, it seems that this whole issue is going to be solved one way or the other. You know, if it's not going to be a peaceful solution, the Austrians are going to move against Serbia and wipe out this threat to their security. Right? And there wouldn't be much that Russia, you know, without the support of the Western powers, really, and in no position to go to war, could do about it. And yet the Russians continue the agitation. And then, so finally, the Germans get drawn into this. And the Germans issue this ultimatum to the Russian government, saying, basically, you accept this, and you get the Serbs to accept it too, or we'll let matters take their course. We got to hear an answer from you, yes or no. If we don't get a positive answer, then we'll allow matters to take their course. We'll assume that we're not going to destroy this. Yeah. So the Russians under enormous pressure accept this, humiliating them. Again, you say, well, the wedge is being driven in deeper, just like at the Moroccan crisis. The wedge gets driven in between Russia and Germany. And yet, that wasn't the consequence, because the Russians knew that Germany took this position because Germany was so dependent on Austria, and that Russia's whole position in European affairs depended on her having a decent relationship with Germany. The Bosnia affair did not lead to a permanent worsening of Russo-German relations because the Russians were thinking in these kind of cold power political terms. And I should say, if you're interested in making a judgment on this whole question of democracy and foreign policy and whether democratic governments have better foreign policies and so on, you're forced to note that autocratic governments find it easier to pursue those kinds of policies than democratic governments would. Democratic governments tend to get more carried away by the emotions of their people. An autocratic government can much more afford to ignore the emotions of their people and think in cold, new power political terms. All right? So that was the effect of the Bosnian crisis. Next time, we're going to talk about a third major crisis in this decade before the war, the second Moroccan crisis of 1911, right, which plays a key role in this whole story. So see you next time.